it's a challenge in politics that too many politicians are not prepared to say, I'm sorry, I screwed up, but we're going to put it right.
Richard Tice.
Chairman of the Reform Party.
One of the most misunderstood parties in British politics.
The left care about everyone and the right care about their people. Is there a bit that people are missing about you and your policy where you see it's actually caring?
It's the quality of our outcomes rather than the quantity of the words. And politics is it's a sales job, and that's all very nice, but if you don't deliver the outcomes, if you don't make lives better for people, at the end of the day, don't be surprised if people get tired of the warm words, actually, that they want some stuff done.
If you were to initiate one major change, if you got into power, what would you do?
The one thing I would do is...
Okay, well, Richard, welcome to the Privileged Man podcast. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for inviting me. It's a great privilege.
Pleasure. Well, as I ask most of our guests, do you think you could just start off right at the beginning and give us a bit of background about where you were brought up and how you were brought up and just, give us a little bit of background?
Yeah, so I was born in Farnham in Surrey in 1964, and we moved up to Northamptonshire in the late 60s. Sounds a long time ago. And look, I was very lucky in life, to be honest. I went to some great schools and I enjoyed sports. I was actually, believe it or not, although I'm 6'2" now, I actually grew very late. So I was quite short. And I used to enjoy sports. I would enjoy football where I played. I was goalkeeper, which is not very good if you're short. So there's a slight sort of anomaly there. I kept wicket. Cricket, and I was, because I was short, I was hooker in rugby. So all of those sort of, that was how I enjoyed my school days. And then eventually, I think I must have maybe eaten a bit more spinach or whether it was sort of school food or whatever. But anyway, eventually I grew, but I didn't really grow properly until I was about 16, 17. And then suddenly shot up. And my dear elder sister, who used to call me Titch, couldn't quite believe what had happened to me. So, I was very lucky. I went to an independent school called Uppingham for 5 years, left there in 1982, and took a year out, travelled around, drove through the Sahara Desert. Which was amazing. We got trapped in one country, and so... had a coup, so we had to sort of basically, we had to get our Land Rover taken out on a ship. I had all sorts of weird and wonderful experiences. And then we had to, in those days, you were sort of barter things. So I bartered a Timex watch for a leaf spring suspension for a Land Rover. I'll never forget that, in the depths of 1982. So those were some of the strange experiences that formed me before I went to university.
Awesome. There's no phoning home in those days, was there?
Was no phoning home. In fact, we ran out of cash in Africa, and because we got trapped. And it was the old post-restant, sending a telegram, waiting around for a day or two and hoping a telegram would come back. And it was just a completely different world. Mm.
Awesome. And I think, to a certain extent, we all miss it a little bit, that's for sure. Well, 82, good year. That's when I came into the world. diving a little bit further back, I've seen you talk about your time at boarding school. You went to boarding school at 8, and you've discussed it as being good for you becoming independent and growing some resilience. Just diving into that a little bit in terms of resilience, because having been to boarding school, I do understand what you mean. Can I just ask, was there some hardship there that built that resilience? Was it always sweet and easy playing?
No, I think anybody who goes away from home, and most people say 8 is pretty young, some go 10, but you learn a lot, and it's not all sweetness and light, and... So it does build up a sense of independence, and that you've got to take some rough with the smooth, and you've got to get on with people, and there's a sort of sense of team spirit that builds up, particularly if you're lucky enough to enjoy sport, team sports, which is a big thing in independent schools, boarding schools. That does build a camaraderie. But it's the sort of it's that old saying, isn't it? You know, life is the school of knocks, and sometimes it's hard knocks. So yeah, but it.
Got any particular hard knocks that you remember?
Good question. I'll keep thinking through the interview. Nothing instantly occurring as we speak. But you just it's just a bit different, I think. And in those days, you wouldn't see parents for a whole of a half a term. And so, now if you're boarding, then you might have weekly boarding or almost sort of it's very different. So,
yeah. And what about your mum and dad? How close were you to them?
So I was brought up essentially by mum. Parents had basically split sort of when I was give or take not very old. So yeah, we were close, but I think the moment you start to go to boarding school, I think that does give you an extra sense of independence. And mum was, she was from the old school where sort of slightly on the basis of no news is good news, write if you need something. So it was, and her attitude to life, which I very much adopted, is, you've got to get up in the morning, get out and get on. If you want to succeed, if you want to earn some money, if you want to be successful, and nothing just happens. You've got to work for it and you've got to get stuck in. And there's no point just sort of sitting on the touchlines and whinging about it, frankly. And I think that was a sort of a sense of spirit that that was probably the main thing that one learned from mum. And I like to think that stood me in pretty good stead.
I was going to say that sense of independence, that sense of can-do attitude. You talk about how Britain can be great on its own without being in the EU. Do you find that the attitude, do you find that sense of confidence was set at a very early age?
I think it was. I think there's with that sort of sense of resilience and independence comes extra confidence, extra self-belief, and there's probably a link there. I mean, psychologists might say otherwise, but there's probably a link there with being willing to take an extra level of calculated risk. And, I've got a motto. I've got a number of mottos, but one of them, the biggest risk in life is never taking one. And I think generally that stood me in good stead. Sometimes, you take a risk, it doesn't work out, you learn from it. But that is a key thing. And I think that's driven me in terms of my business life, a slightly entrepreneurial, let's try it, maybe try it small and then see how it goes, grow it and learn from it. So I think both in business and then in politics, that's been sort of a core foundation to how I've approached things.
Thank you. And just one sort of final question, I guess, about that upbringing. Was there a sense of pride and nationalism that was in your family that you were very proud of Great Britain and Britain in itself? Was that something that came through from your upbringing, you think?
I think we just had a very traditional Christian, without being sort of excessive, but a sort of just a traditional English family that go to church a fair bit and, celebrated all the traditional Christmas festivals and things. So it was an overall sense of confidence and belief in our own nation, our own United Kingdom, really. It was almost like just the expression, just natural. And so you would think, well, anybody who grows up in their own country, wherever it is is going to believe and hopefully love their own country. It was just a sort of a natural evolution. This is who you are, this is the country you live in, and you have pride in it, and you try and push on and make a success within it.
And do you feel that when you were travelling and you were going to the Sahara and you were going to in your travels ever since, do you feel that there is that sense that, you know, I've read that you feel that a lot of people talk down Britain, a lot of people talk down the country and its capabilities. Do you feel that there is still brand Britain is a good thing abroad, or do you feel that we're suffering from our own internal issues and internal confidence?
I think good question. It probably ebbs and flows a bit. I wonder whether actually those of us that are quite close to sort of the world of current affairs, we're probably too close to the wood, we can't see the trees. And actually, I think that brand Britain elsewhere in the world is much stronger than very often we sort of end up in a pickle of a debate here in the UK. And, I mean, many countries are having challenges at the moment for a whole bunch of different reasons, as is the UK. But I do think we have got a very strong brand, and actually, the foundation of that, I would strongly argue, is the monarchy. I mean, the late Queen was the most famous, most admired, most respected lady in the world. I'm quite sure of that. And that was part of our absolute foundation stone. So, yeah, and that sort of reputation, that's enduring. And yeah, you can have all sorts of political rows and get into a heated debate about this. But fundamentally, I mean, I live in London, and to, you know, it's luckily the sun has finally come out, and you see the tourists around the great central tourist sites, Buckingham Palace, all the various palaces around, and actually think, wow, you know, people are still coming to the UK, they're still coming to London, and you know, the changing of the guard at the same time every day, it's a real thing, it's something, and that's part of it. So yeah,
it's really interesting. I having lived abroad for 12 years, I had. I remember famously, well, I guess not that famously, but in our family in 2015, I reckon, when the referendum was coming up, and I was in Hong Kong doing some business, and I remember being on the phone and looking over Hong Kong. I was looking over a whole territory and a whole trading hub and a whole, hundreds of years, but a good 150 years, Hong Kong was an incredibly successful place where people loved living and loved doing business and loved being and working and bringing up families. And I just thought, well, you know what? This was built on brand Britain. And yes, of course, I know the history. You know, some of it wasn't all kosher. But I did feel like there's a trust in Britain. And British people, there's a trust in the rule of law that people now having been back here, people don't necessarily see if they haven't lived and worked abroad.
I think that key point, actually, you had the foundation stone of the monarchy, and the other foundation stone, apart from the fact that English is the most spoken language across the world, and so that, in a sense, makes people aware of the United Kingdom, but also the trust in the English legal system as fundamentally being of integrity, huge precedent. It's been here for hundreds of years. It's built up, grown up, and there's a sort of a bedrock of belief in it. And of course, many other legal systems and judicial systems have taken that and then developed from there. And sometimes learn from it. We're not saying it's perfect, but there's a depth of trust in that, which is very powerful. A lot of this stuff we just take for granted.
So that's brand Britain. And back home, it's like, you know, you're talking about building up Britain. You're talking about how Britain could, I'm not going to say it could be great again. I'm not going to put words in your mouth, but along those lines, And yet the right wing of, I guess, in this country, maybe in many others, is seen as being times heartless, a bit dangerous, times uncaring. Where are we going to bridge this gap between being proud of Britain and being caring at the same time? Do you follow?
No, I do. It's quite interesting, actually, because fundamentally, if at the end of the day, if your economy is doing well, and if there's that old expression that a rising tide lifts all boats. So if an economy is doing well, then actually anybody who's prepared to go and work at whatever level, whatever age, you're going to do better. And if you look at the 80s and the 90s, we had a relatively short recession, painful in the early 90s, but nevertheless, for 20 years, we grew at between 2.5% and 3.5% per year, and everybody was getting better off. And actually, that was an amazing economic period, and there were some challenges at the beginning of it. But if you look at it, you could argue, I think with some justification, that Tony Blair's Labour years between 97 and 07, 08, before he left office, I mean, the politics of the Labour Party then was probably to the right of what I call the social democracy of where the Conservative Party is now, which is a much higher taxes, much higher state spending, much higher level of sort of, you know, nanny state will look after you. So it's quite, it's, I think, so I'm not sure it's right or left per se. I just think there's been an evolution, and a lot of that, I think, is down to confident leadership and a sense of conviction and a real sense of where are you taking it, and whether you're running a growing charity or whether you're running a small business or a big business, or indeed trying to run a political party or running a country, you've got to have a real sense of belief and conviction. And you look at the great leaders of the country. I mean, Thatcher had that, whether we like it or not. Tony Blair had that, and people did disagree with the politics, but they did have a sense of direction, and I think that's really, really important. And if you look around other countries around the world, certainly in continental Europe, those nations are drifting to the right. But I don't think people would say that the likes of France or Sweden or those nations like that they're uncaring. I think that it's much more about competence. I think just whatever you're doing in all the public services, if you do something efficiently and competently, then actually that's the best way of running things, whether it's your health system, whatever you've got, whether it's your benefit system to help those who are genuinely in need. And I just think you've just got to be competent about these things. And there's, in all walks of life, there's nothing worse than something that doesn't work or doesn't quite meet your hopes and expectations. And I think I think particularly for young people today who've got completely different challenges to the way that certainly I grew up, because we didn't have mobile phones, we didn't have smartphones, we didn't have social media. There was none of this stuff. You basically just, you sort of got out, chatted to some mates and went and kicked a ball.
And with that, we take a quick pause today to bring Monumental to your attention. Monumental is a personal and professional development platform tailored for men in their professional prime that I founded a few years ago. We're dedicated to igniting purpose, nurturing wisdom, enabling you to craft a legacy that stands the test of time. Our programs are unparalleled in the leadership development space, offering content that truly transforms lives, backed by a commitment to confidentiality that sets us apart. Explore more at monumental.global or take a scorecard in the description below. Now, let's get back to the conversation.
Pretty simple, wasn't it?
It was, yeah,
it was pretty simple. And I think that that is the, you know, there's a complex mind, isn't there, in younger people now. There's just so much information, so overblown by information, it's difficult to actually know where they're actually sitting in life, which is why I feel that the fundamentals of parenting and being present with children is just so important, which is why I've got fair ideas about boarding school and what it does to kids, to especially young kids.
Yeah, and I think there are many more distractions and I think challenges for young people, much of which is so new. The truth is, it's an experiment, and most parents it's a challenge anyway, bringing up children. I mean, I've got three, and there are glorious moments, but there are challenges to it, and you're always slightly sort of learning on the job, so to speak. Sure. And
if you were to slip into number 10 this summer, how or maybe the autumn, how would you go about dealing with that? The mental health crisis is so evident. The statistics are showing it, that, you know, the smartphones and social media is, you know, frankly ruining children's childhood. You know, you're a defender of free speech, which is then very in conflict with how to deal with tech platforms. How do we actually deal with this? What would you in government?
It's very topical at the moment, and actually I'm just looking for it, because there are tech ways of dealing with this, and here we are. I've just got it here. So this is it's called a Wise phone, and it looks just like an iPhone, but it doesn't take all of the apps, so it looks cool, feels cool. I'm just trying to dig it out as we speak, and I was given it as a sort of trial. So I'm sure I showed it on there. Looks just the business. Looks just like an iPhone. Really slim, really cool. But parents have got controls over it, and you don't automatically get all the apps. You can only download a specified approved apps, and. So I thought that was very interesting. I think that sort of thing could really take off. And I think we've got to be prepared to look at it. I really do. I was the governor of a secondary school that had really been struggling. And when I took it over back in 2005, I mean, it was really struggling in special measures. And we turned it around. But the biggest single improvement to student behavior and performance was banning mobile phones. It's the biggest by a country mile, literally in the space of a week. Everything changed, and there was a bit of resistance. So I think that's very powerful. And I think we've got to be brave enough to say the truth is, these phones, it's an experiment, and we're seeing real harms being done to children. Social media is a new experiment, whatever it is, a decade old, plus or minus. And so we're having to learn on the job, and we're learning where it's good, and we're learning where actually there's some real harms. And we've got to be brave enough to say, yeah, there's some stuff we've got to control, and parents have a massive role, of course. But as I said, it's really hard parenting, particularly if all the other children in the class have got a smartphone and you say, no, my child's going to have no phone or a brick phone, then that's really hard. And yeah. So and I think with social media, there's a lot of work going on at the moment, but the current status quo is not tenable. So, and I think that's different to free speech as an adult. And I think we've got to be brave enough to say, there is a difference. And whether you say that's 16 or 18, fine. Happy to have open-minded about that. But below 16?
Yeah, I agree with you. There's a guy called Jonathan Haidt.
Yes.
Wrote a book called The Anxious Generation. I don't know if you've seen
it. Absolutely. In fact, funny enough, I was on some media on the BBC with him about 10 days, 2 weeks ago. at the launch of his latest book, and I'd had a sort of preview of it, and yeah, we were interviewed together, and I just, yeah, I think he's obviously, you know, one of the most respected in the world, and he's onto something.
Yeah, definitely. And I've joined this whole sort of movement, SFC, the Smartphone Free Childhood. And, you know, whilst my kids are only 4 and 1, you know, I can see where this is going, where the algorithm's going, AI, it's going to, I mean, you know, yeah, the whole thing is going to become more and more advanced. And, I said this the other day on LinkedIn, you know, I cannot, even as a 42-year-old, the only way to actually get free of it is to turn it off.
Yeah.
Or leave it behind.
And there's a real conflict because, yes, you can have parent-enabled apps and things on you know, your Apples and your Samsung to Android-type phones. But the truth is they make a lot of money by selling the apps as well as selling the phone. So it's not in their interest, to be honest. You could say, well, why hasn't Apple taken the lead on this? Well, because financially it's just not in their interest. And we have to be brave enough to recognize that. If I was the boss of Apple, you've got responsibilities to shareholders, you understand why they do it. So that's where actually, you know, whilst I'm a fan of small state, I'm also a fan of smart state. And I think the state has got to be smart in this area.
Good. That's great. Well, I mean, on that front, you've got my vote. Because honestly, this is, I think, probably one of the, as a young parent, not that I am young, my children are young, this is the one area that leaves me to think about where I'm living, where I'm going to bring them up, what school I'm going to bring them up in as well. So you can see it in the statistics. They are very, very, very clear that we've got a serious mental health issue with our younger generation at the moment. It is our responsibility to do something about it. We'll put Zuckerberg up in, you know, the Senate the fifth time and do nothing about it. So just coming back to being the care factor, if I can, outside in, it looks as though, you know, the left care about everyone and the right care about their people. Outside in, broad brush. Is there a bit that people are missing about you and your policies that is actually where you see it's actually caring? Because on the face of it, let's just go with immigration. It doesn't sound very caring to send the boats back, for example.
You know, okay, so I think I would challenge the first premise that the less care about everybody and the right only care about the right or their own. I don't accept that premise. And I think our core economic policy is the most helpful to the lowest paid, the least well off, and the young. So if you increase the starting point at which you pay income tax from 12.5 grand to £20,000, for everybody, that's an extra almost £30 a week net. And actually, for the lowest paid, that's real money. And yet we're the first party that's ever talked about the importance of lifting that threshold. And that has the biggest, single, fastest difference. And that would be transformational. 7 million people would pay no income tax and would be, so I think that's a remarkable thing. Also, there's a whole group of people who are trapped on, do I stay on benefits or do I go to work? Okay, there's a real benefits trap. It's a really serious problem and challenge. And that would help a lot of people trapped in that calculation at the moment. How am I going to have more at the end of the week? So I think I challenge that very premise. Look, on the immigration point of view, obviously there's two elements to it. You've got lawful immigration, you've got unlawful. And I would simply say our policy actually is the kindest and most compassionate policy on the boats, because within 2 weeks you'd stop people dying. Simple as that. 15 people have died this year that we know of, and under the current status quo, and I don't think there's enough discussion and debate and reference to that. That's just across the channel. In the Med, it's no one really knows, but it's in the thousands. And we know that basically when Australia, they had a variant of it, they had a pushback policy, it stopped. And so people stopped dying. And so in that sense, I just think our policy is it's the kindest and it's the safest policy. And so you can then sort of get into the detail behind it. You probably don't want to do that. So I think I reject the premise. What I might accept is that we can be pretty robust in the way we talk about it, the way we talk about a bunch of our policies, really. But that's mainly probably because most of us at the top end of the party, we've all been around the block a few times. We're north of 50. We've been through the school of hard knocks. Most of us have been through some form of business type career, and you get stuck in and you don't go in for lots of linguistic waffle. You just tell it as you see it and you get on. And I think that's probably a key part of why we might be, I would argue, misinterpreted by
linguistic waffle.
Yeah, it's quality, not quantity.
I don't
quantity.
Think that's a misinterpretation. I think that's pretty bang on. Why people would see it that way, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it is. Look, it's for us. It's the quality of our outcomes rather than the quantity of the words. And you know, some beautiful wordsmiths who've been through politics, and politics is it's a sales job, and that's all very nice. But if you don't deliver the outcomes, if you don't make lives better for people, at the end of the day, don't be surprised if people get tired of the warm words, actually, that they want some stuff done.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I think that is, you know, no decision is a decision. And it feels as though that this, you know, hasn't been fair to it. It doesn't feel as though it's fair to anyone. But, I mean, ultimately, the problem is so big, isn't it? You know, it starts in Africa. You could say that it's, you know, that the serious climate issues are starting it, and you know that they're suffering traditionally, and there's a whole bunch of corruption in Africa and across, you know, the equatorial world, really, that drives people towards Europe. And obviously Europe is the perception is that it is definitely the softest touch in the world.
But I guess that's partly because we've, you know, over history, sort of Western Europe has probably developed the greatest wealth, much longer actually over time than America. And so it's sort of built up. But as we've gained that wealth, and so you become, I guess, slightly more complacent, slightly more used to everything being comfortable and, but actually, it's a competitive world out there. And what America's achieved in the last, 80 years since the Second World War, in terms of growth and I guess the 50 years before that, is extraordinary. Way, way outperforming what we've achieved in frankly, most Western European nations. And you do wonder whether it's almost like you're going up and then you get a little bit sort of comfortable, and a little bit decadent and a little bit complacent, and that just takes the pressure off. And stuff comes from that. But fundamentally, you still need good leadership. And if you haven't got good leadership, then you can end up in any walk of life in a right pickle very quickly. And there's a really big debate at the moment about nation state and borders, and some people sort of don't believe in the nation state. They don't believe in borders. They just think everyone should roam ever and that's all jolly nice. We have a very different view. We think that actually pride and belief and confidence in your own country is fundamental to who you are. And if you believe in the nation state, you've got to believe in borders and actually that your role is as the government, as the leadership of the country, is to fundamentally, it's to defend your own citizens, protect them, and hopefully make outcomes for them improve.
My own mind coming back to sort of, well, what is kind? What is caring? And that sense of, because so many people I know secretly, because it's not necessarily the popular thing to say, agree with you. That was clear in Brexit. You know, that was very, very clear that people silently came up and voted for the unpopular view, if you like. And I'm just wondering now, like, you know, given that what has happened, given various different economic indicators, I'm sure you're very used to answering this question. You know, does that argument still stand up? That being, no, I'm not saying alone, but being more independent, does it? You've talked a lot about economic policy and you know, the economics and how money matters. Has that really worked?
So I think it's about who makes decisions. And if you believe in the nation state, then you believe in sovereignty. And but any leader of any entity is going to make mistakes. But if you believe in democracy, then the great thing is that if your leaders are running the country that you voted, they'll make a bunch of decisions. They'll get some right, they'll get some wrong. But if they get too many wrong, you'll throw them out at the next election. Mm-hmm. Whereas, and the reason that we were so against the EU is that it was too easy for people to say, well, it wasn't my fault, Gov. Them over there, they made the decisions and we had to gold plate them because that's... So I just believe in actually pushing down power, devolving power as locally and as close to the people as possible and then holding people to account to perform. So, and I would defend that opportunity to the hilt. So... Yeah, if you take something like Brexit, do I think we'd have done a better job? Yeah, absolutely. I would say that, wouldn't we? And I don't think many people really claim that the current government have done a good job of taking advantage of the opportunity. But here's the thing, the opportunity is still there. And that is for our leaders to decide how to deal with it. And I just think that's... It's the same in any walk of life. You've got to perform and you've got to be held to account. And if you don't, then you know someone else is going to come along and say, well, I can do a better job. And whether it's your shareholders, whether it's the trustees of a charity or voters in a democracy, ultimately they'll say, well, I'm going to vote for the next guy. Or girl, sorry.
I think what's really interesting and what is coming up as you say that is your entrepreneurship, your entrepreneurial background, which so many leaders don't have, right? And so many leaders are sort of much more strategic and bigger picture and potentially more corporate in the way in which they go about, govern, and even speak in terms of, you know, circling back and all the rest of it. There is this element there of bluntness that I think is just missing out of the political, I guess, the political landscape at the moment. Is that something where you learned to speak your mind? Or were you like very blunt from the beginning and sort of black and white in that way?
Yeah, I mean, actually, relative to many other people who are risk takers and entrepreneurs, many people say that I can be diplomatic, sometimes overly diplomatic. So, but I think if you're involved in small businesses and growing businesses and then running businesses, being chief exec of medium business, making a decision strategically to sell at the right time, getting stuck in, troubleshooting another business as chief exec. You know, if you've been the boss who ultimately is accountable on numerous occasions, then you just develop a sense of. And so I'm an impatient person. I want action and I want it, you know, rapidly, to be honest. And I look forward to getting up every day and to jumping out of bed and cracking on. And so that is it comes back to this whole element of risk and an appetite for it.
Yeah, I was going to say that. I mean, it's like, and not worrying about failure.
Correct. And when one has failed and, you know, failed in a couple of elections, for example, I don't look back. I always just keep looking forwards and just it's gone. It's history. There's nothing you can do about it. Learn from it where you need to, but just push on. And I think people really respect that. You know, in countries like America, you haven't really been a successful entrepreneur until you've gone bust at least a couple of times. And here there's a sort of stigma with or you tried something and it didn't work out. And that's disastrous because that actually prevents risk taking. It prevents people trying new ideas. And sometimes you just got to go with your gut and have a view. Yeah, I'm not talking about sort of completely mad, wild risks, but you look at something and then you say, yeah, we're going to have to give it a go. It might work, it might not, on the balance of probabilities. But as long as you've got a mechanism to quickly monitor it and tweak it, change it, or heaven forbid, if it's going badly wrong, then you might have to just reverse it.
And did you have any of those experiences, or have you had any of those experiences? I mean, you talk about going bust. I remember Richard Branson saying you wouldn't go into business with anyone who hasn't gone bust. It's a throwaway remark a bit, but I mean, I think he's telling the story you are, which is like you've got to have been to that place to understand what it's like and to grow back up. I mean, did any of your businesses?
One of the businesses I was running, we invested in sort of growing other growing businesses in a sort of small, almost like sort of venture capital, angel investment type thing. And we had a couple that went well and we had plenty that frankly went badly. And one in particular was just, give or take, just dodgy. So, that's just part of it. And you learn from it and try not to do it again.
Tell us a bit about the dodgy bit.
Yeah, it was just where someone's basically just created something that's frankly, it was a semi-scam. And all of a sudden the money's gone and we've all been there. And it's like now, the scammers and the fraudsters, whether it's your bank accounts, whether it's all different. It's got so sophisticated. So, if you're prepared to take risks, then some will go wrong. There's an old expression in business, which is the first loss is the best loss. And that willingness to accept it's gone wrong, you've made a mistake, and you just deal with it. And I think it's a challenge in politics that too many politicians are not prepared to say, I'm sorry, I screwed up, but we're going to put it right.
I even write about it quite often.
Yeah. You know,
looking at Question Time, for example, where, you know, there's the leader of the country and the leader of the opposition, two of the most powerful people in the country, talking to each other like children. It's just, do you think it ever was or ever should be a forum where real accountability is? Or is it just going to be this pantomime forever?
I think in the world we're at, it's many of these formats now are pantomimes. And the question is, if you want to have a serious discussion about policy issues, how better is it? We've got to find different ways of doing it. And look, our own media has a role to play and can be very bad at this, very bad at helping, having a proper debate about this stuff. So we've got to find different formats. And actually, if you think about it, things like this, like an hour-long chat on a podcast, whether it's audio, whether it's video, people can dig into stuff. And there's different ways of putting your policies out there. We're looking at some at the moment where you just say, well, actually, it doesn't need the silly, chippy comments, the gotcha moments from the press. You just say, no, I've got a serious thing to say, and I'm going to put it out there in a different way. And maybe those that do that well will secure a greater percentage of people who say, actually, yeah, forget all the noise and the stuff and the screaming and the hollering from the touchlines. Actually, there's some meat behind this. So I'll give you an example. You know, I think the state of healthcare in the UK is embarrassing. The outcomes are appalling. And so we've got an ambitious way, policies, ideas, how we could get to zero waiting lists in 2 years. Now, some might say it's impossible. I disagree. Sure, require to do things a bit differently, require some effort and would require some extra money. But I think it's right to be ambitious to try and get there. And I like a proper grown-up debate about that. Instead, historically in elections, you've had all that sort of semi-shouting, 24 hours to save the NHS. Well, actually, you know, I think we can do things differently. I think for the first time, the country's ready to have a grown-up debate about, okay, three of the points of delivery is what most Western nations have, actually. That's the reality. It's not just the NHS in the UK. But there's different ways of delivering it. And if our outcomes are amongst the worst, and we're spending about the average or just above the average, then we're clearly doing something wrong. And I mean, most Western nations literally laugh at our waiting lists. And they laugh in sadness. So, I want to be at the heart of a proper debate. And I'm not saying our solutions are completely perfect. But I tell you what, they're going down pretty well to people we talk about. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, I mean...
And coming back to your earlier point, it's a caring thing. Get it right, and the least will off, the most vulnerable will get seen faster, quicker, with better outcomes. So... that proves my point.
Yeah, I mean, look, I mean, it's interesting. I'm married to an American, so I mean, we talk about this a lot in terms of what's available, what healthcare is available, how much it costs. You know, over there, it's a complete scandal in a completely different way. As we know from the Isle of Wight, the one thing that is, I've got as an entrepreneur and as a politician to ask you about is how would you deal with the shit that is being put in our waterways. How would you deal with like a Thames water?
Yeah, actually, I've talked about this since August, September 2021, when I first started on a radio show with Talk Radio, because I spotted that the water companies, a lot of them were overseas owned, and they were taking huge profits by way of, actually, but almost through the back door, through interest on shareholder loans, and that actually the customers were being ripped off, and Southern Water was a particular case in point. And so I was well on this very early, and that helps me develop what I think is a better model for the ownership and management of utilities. But governments can be very good at funding things, but they're generally very bad at managing things. So the best of both worlds is to say, well, let's have 50% public ownership, 50% owned by British pension funds on behalf of British pensioners, but private sector management. And they can be well remunerated and rewarded for doing a good job where, you know, basically you dramatically reduce the leaks in pipes. You've got enough water in the reservoirs, and you've got the right quantity of capacity to treat rainwater and sewage so that it doesn't overflow and you have to end up using an excuse to pump it out into the sea, which is, I mean, it's madness that this is going on. And it's, but if you look, I think the water companies were privatized back in the early 1990s, I think. And it's how they were privatized then and the ownership of them now. I mean, it's a scandal of a failure of regulation by the regulators and a failure of oversight by parliamentarians. And some very smart private equity people have made off like complete bandits. Look at Thames Water as a case in point. I mean, it's truly unbelievable. It's teetering on the edge of bankruptcy. And if it has to be picked up by the state, then all of the shareholders and all of the bond and debt holders, they should all be wiped out. The idea that we'd in any way bail them out is a nonsense. I think our model is an interesting one. Again, we're the only party that's putting that forward. A lot of politicians, frankly, don't understand it. It's called a joint venture, but I think it's as close to the best of all worlds.
Yeah, it needs to be sorted in some capacity, doesn't it? Do you think there's a way of bringing people? Do you see a place where we can live in a bit more harmony rather than constantly going at each other?
I think that... the nature of politics is you've got a strong view and so you're going to put it. I think that where you've got proportional representation as an electoral system, subject to certain conditions and minimum thresholds, so it's not complete chaos, but actually you end up, I think, with a more consensual arrangement where you sort of know that... You're going to achieve some of your things, but not everything. And I think that can be more consensual. And there's probably some good examples of that. So from a political perspective, I think that would be the biggest single difference. I guess the other point, actually coming back to the earlier discussion about with children and social media, maybe us politicians and aspiring politicians, maybe we're childish in the way that we use social media and messaging and short sound bites and punchy sound bites. And I'm probably guilty of it myself at times when you get really frustrated, that actually that is not conducive to the situation. So in a sense, social media has probably made it worse than it was 30, 40 years ago. I don't recall the political environment being quite so brutal in the 1990s, for example.
Yeah, I mean, well, John Major, I mean, he could be brutal to him.
Oh, man. Except spitting image.
Yeah, well, right, exactly. All he wanted to do was eat peas and watch cricket. Yeah, I hasten to add, I was 10 at the time, so I can't really remember it. But I do remember watching spitting image. But I think this, I mean, so within that gives me some hope. There is obviously the way in which we're set up, which is very two-party, if you like, and a bit like the US as well. And I think that that's what, you know, I hear a lot from Bobby Kennedy, and I say I hear a lot, it's not my mate, but I watch a lot of what he's saying, and a lot of it's common sense. A lot of it, what he's saying, is like it's representing a lot of people who feel like they just don't want to vote for Trump and they just don't want to vote for Biden. But CNN, Fox, et cetera, aren't going to allow him airtime. So the majority over 40s aren't actually going to let him have his word, so he won't get in. What do you see, or how would you see that ever changing, both, I guess, in the US and here?
I'm not sure in the US I could see that ever changing. I think there is a prospect here of getting proportional representation. I think if there was a referendum on it, which I would support very much so, I think it would probably be 2/3, 1/3, possibly 70-30. I hear a lot on the doors, "Oh, Richard, it's a wasted vote. I'd vote for you if it was PR." There's a much greater awareness of PR. And the biggest indicator for it is that when nations have PR, the average turnout is 9 or 10% higher than the average turnout in a UK general election. Give or take, that's another 3 million people voting. That's really powerful. That's another 3 million people who think, actually, my vote counts, my voice counts, I'm going to be bothered to cast my vote. So, yeah, I could be wrong, and people might say, well, these are examples in other nations where it's still very brutal and divisive and they've got PR. But I just think it's, you come back sort of being an optimist and hopeful. Well, I'm optimistic that PR in this country would be much better. I think it also encourages new people, new parties, new disruptors to come and challenge the status quo. And I think that's a good thing. It's a good thing in any walk of life. And yeah, I'm not afraid of competition. If I get complacent and someone comes and eats my lunch, that's my own fault.
Keeps you sharp. So on just rounding things up, and I ask my guest this question, the final one, each time. If you were to initiate one major change, if you got into power, so to speak, what would you do? What would be the number one thing that you would like to? And we've spoken quite a lot about it, but what would be the number one change you'd like to make?
Obviously, Liverpool winning the Premier League every season. No, sorry. that's my favourite football team. The one thing I would do is I would lift the starting point for income tax to £20,000. That, I think, would be the fastest, most transformational thing for millions of people on low incomes. Fundamentally, there's a simple slogan we have, which is make work pay. Work's a good thing. It's good for your mental health. It's good for the example you set to your family, to your friends, to your local community, and it contributes. And I think it's, without work, who are we? What are we? How do we progress? So, yeah, that's the simple answer. It's pretty functional. It's pretty financial, but fundamentally, work's a good thing. Let's make work pay.
Nice. Well, thank you so much for being on the podcast. I've really enjoyed it.
No, great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So thank you for joining me, Pete Hunt, on the Privileged Man podcast. If you're interested in learning more about our personal and professional development platform for men in their professional prime, please visit the website monumental.global for more details.